sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Lots to talk about, lots to get into. Got a couple of days off, a couple of days to enjoy. You know, it's days, you know, I had a really an amazing weekend with my daughter. Things that, you know, I like to take time, as I think every father should with their daughter, every parent should with their child, take time just to connect, to bond, to build those memories that hopefully will last a lifetime. And this weekend really was one of those things that, you know, for, you know, to let you in on the gig, for Christmas, you know, my daughter is a huge basketball nut right now, 11 years old. You know, I want to, everything is basketball right now. That's the frame of field of thought, the field of vision is I love basketball. Tomorrow could be something else, who knows, but for right now, it's basketball. So I thought over Christmas, you know, I don't like buying toys and stuff to get broken in a couple of days and they sit in a corner because we got a whole basement full of stuff that was bought, played with once or twice, and now sits somewhere out of sight, out of mind. So the thought was, is, you know, we'll take a weekend, we'll go see an NCAA women's basketball game. The tournament we knew was coming up in March. I looked online, hey, where do we find it? Got tickets to the round in Toledo, Ohio. Thought it'd be a great weekend. Drive through Cleveland, visit my family. Hi, how you doing? Great to see you. We're moving along. A couple of basketball games, good weekend, things to do, and you know, bonding and all of that stuff. And it was phenomenal. And, you know, not all that expensive either, which is good for my wallet, but a phenomenal weekend of showing my daughter what is possible. You know, it's one thing that, you know, she's learning to play the game of basketball, learning the skills and learning what she can be. And the growth in her in the last 3-4 months has been remarkable. And it's the kind of self-esteem that I think is so important, and not just my daughter, but everyone's child, that earned the self-esteem where they see that they're growing, they know they're getting better and they're learning. It's that hands-on experiential learning, that hands-on thing that, you know, I see the improvement right before my very eyes. And then to start thinking, hey, if I've improved from here, where can I go? How far can I take this? Which over the weekend we got to see women who were, and I shouldn't even say women, these were young women. They were, you know, I think girls, 19, 20 years old, 21, who were playing their hearts out at a level that was just phenomenal. And my daughter just sat there with awe and stars in her eyes, and it was really just a fantastic thing. And before I move on any further, I want to thank the women at the Arizona State University basketball program, because we stayed at this hotel in Toledo, a nice hotel. I booked it a couple of months ago. And, you know, as we were walking in after the first two games on Saturday, the Arizona State women's team were staying in the same hotel. And I recognized one of the women on the team, and I go, hey, would you mind taking a picture with my daughter? She's a big fan, because over the summer we had gone to Tempe, Arizona, to Arizona State University, to do some interviews of some professors on the campus at Arizona State. And my daughter loved the campus and loved the surroundings and loved Tempe. Now she's got a team she's going to root for. And, you know, I just asked the one girl, figuring, now if she got a picture with this girl, it'll be nice. She got 12 of the 13 girls on the team to come together and take a really nice picture with my daughter, and I greatly appreciated that. I know that I'm sure they remember what it was like to be 11 years old and being in that position, and they were just the most wonderful young women, and I appreciate that, because that is going to send so much of a message to my child over the next several years as she grows. And I just want to throw that out first. But the reason that I'm bringing this up is, you know me, I talk very little about sports. I talk very little about my family other than when I see that it's necessary. This is one of those moments, one of these weekends where you go, this is something you absolutely have to talk about, because I'm right before my very eyes, I'm watching the maturation of, you know, my one and only, my firstborn child, my first daughter going into moving into the teenage years, into adulthood, kind of moving forward, and that growth, and it's amazing to watch. And you know, over the weekend, as I started thinking through some of this stuff, and bringing it back to education, everything that my daughter has really done well, and has grown from, and has felt a sense of ownership of, has been things she's done with. She started here, she's finished here. There's been an obvious growth. There's been an experience that only she has for herself. And maybe this is hard to understand, but you know, the way I'm running through this is, you know, without this hands-on experiential component, had I just said, "Oh, you're a wonderful basketball player," even though she can't make a layup, and kept heaping this praise on her, she would have never felt this growth. And, you know, over the weekend, I saw her almost right before my eyes grow and mature. And I bring that back to that earned self-esteem, that earned dignity, that earned idea of I can achieve. And it's not because she filled in some bubble test. It's not because she can regurgitate where she has this. It's because she gets it. She understands it. She's taken ownership of it. And I bring this back to education because, you know, as I think about these standardized tests that I've opted her out of, and we had a nice long talk about it over there. Like when you've got a 7-hour drive to and from, you've got plenty of time to talk and plenty of time, to really flesh things out. And, you know, we talked about the testing, you know, and I made my position completely clear to her, saying, look, it's not that I'm anti-testing. It's that I'm anti this test, you know, and bring it back to basketball. You know, every time you step on the court, you're being tested for the practices, your homework, so to speak. Every time you step on the court, every game is a test, and you get instant feedback whether you know what you're doing or whether you're doing it right and whether you're not. To me, that's the kind of tests that are important, where you, okay, I've got it in front of me. I either know I did it right or I know I did it wrong. And you have growth from doing something right. You have growth from doing a good job of doing the right thing and of being on the right path. And, of course, you have some corrective measures if you're not. These PSSA tests, which I've been just kind of focused on here recently, they don't give you that. In fact, the results don't come out until at the earliest June, and to the parents, probably not until October. I see nothing positive in this. So, you know, that's kind of where my mind was going this weekend as I was looking at this, at the situation that we're in. And, you know, the more I sit back and I go, you know, this is the absolute right decision. And I think more people are going to come to it once we realize that this whole testing regime is just the wrong direction. And what we need, more hands-on stuff. So we're going to talk about that a little bit tonight. I got some other things in store. Andrew Brady from Union Solidarity International is in Philadelphia from the UK. We're going to get him on the program. We're going to talk about the minimum wage. Lots of stuff tonight. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So we were in Toledo for the 3 days for the women's NCAA basketball tournament, which was phenomenal. We just had a ball, and my daughter's like, "Can we do this every year? Can we make this our thing?" And I'm like, "You know, maybe, you know, because I really liked the idea. You go to a city like Toledo, which, you know, even my 11-year-old's looking around, going, there are some problems here, because as you look at a city like Toledo, much like Allentown or Bethlehem or some other places." What you end up with are areas that make you go, there's so much work, so many things that need to be done, so many things that we could do. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I've got a call on line one. Hey, how you doing? What's on your mind?
I want to kind of do a little segue. I heard Rick talking about college sports. I wondered if he saw that the NRLB has ruled tentatively that the football players at Northwestern University do have the right to organize.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit about that later on the program. And, yes, I did see it. I think it's a huge step in the right direction. I think it's something that we need to be looking at. Because you look, in fact, last night I just turned on the movie Blue Chips. Have you ever seen that with Nick Nolte?
No, but I've heard it's excellent.
Where, you know, at the end of it, he goes into this you know, very, very poignant bit of rage saying, look, you know, this player, you know, we gave cash to, this player, the family we gave a house to, and all of this stuff because it's about the money. College sports at that level, at when you get into March Madness level, it's about the money. And at some point, we've got to say, you know what? A kid who his mother dies and someone gives him a suit and a plane ticket to get home, that shouldn't be illegal.
That should be fine. I mean, I had my alma mater. One of our star players one season was a kid who had to transfer from Maryland because of a television.
No, that's nuts.
It was. No, I mean, we were glad to take him, obviously. I mean, yeah, we were glad to have him, but the circumstances also,
Yeah.
I was trying to, I'm sure that you talked a lot about the Hobby Lobby case, but this is something that a program that I consider not a, I'd almost call it a cousin program, which is Democracy Now! Made a quick mention to, is that Hobby Lobby case is not about contraception. That is kind of, to me at least, that is about another advance of the concept of corporate personhood. Is now what they're trying to say is that a corporation has the same rights to practice, you know, the same right to impose religion as an individual does.
No, I firmly disagree with that. And for me, I take the position, I took the day that this was brought up, this is not about abortion, this is not about contraception, this is about employees and employers' rights. This is about a worker's, an employer's right to impose their will on a worker, no matter what it is. To me, this is an employment issue. Get away from the religious arguments. Get away from all of that other stuff. This is about giving power and control to corporate America over their workforce. That simple. And for me, I got to be honest with you. To me, this is the reason we do away with employer-based health care altogether. We should have never gotten involved with it, and it should go away immediately, in my view.
Didn't mean to kick the hornet's nest.
No, it is what it is. I mean, really, do we have to have employer-based health care? Is it something that we should tie specifically to a job, or is it, do you believe, a right that every citizen of this country should have, regardless of station, religion, creed, or ethnicity? It should be an absolute right of citizenship.
I just, as I said, though, when I had heard, I think it was one of the NPR programs along the same line, that the idea that this might actually be a case where, Citizens United gave a corporation speech rights. There's some people that are saying that this Hobby Lobby and, what is it, Cumberland Cabinetry case?
Yes.
Is a case where now what they're trying to say is, okay, and companies also have the right to practice, to exercise the freedom of religion. I can accept it.
You can accept that companies have a right to impose their religious beliefs on you?
No, I'm saying I can accept that that's what the case is about.
Okay. Well, that's what they want the case to be about. I say it shouldn't even be that. It's not even that complicated in my view.
Okay. All right.
All right. I appreciate the call, man.
You're welcome. Bye.
Always great talking with you. Thanks so much. No, and look, at the end of it, with that case, to me, it comes down to, should an employer have the ability to dictate what happens in the four walls of your house? And it comes to a whole bunch of things. Do they have the right to say, well, if you smoke, we're going to fire you? Do they have the right to say, well, you had French fries and we know it, you're fired? should they have any of those rights outside of what you do when you punch that clock? I mean, to me, that's the real issue. But they want to make it about everything other than that. And I think that's wrong. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a major speech on trade policy at the Center for American Progress Tuesday, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka called for a global New Deal and trade policies designed to create a virtuous cycle for working people worldwide.
We need new policies to spark a virtuous cycle where rising wages fuel demand, not flimsy debt-driven demand, but healthy demand, which in turn spark business investment and more jobs and higher wages in a strong cycle of global growth that works for all our families, for the environment, and for our communities. We need a global New Deal, a worldwide program to bring the basic infrastructure of modern society, electricity, water, schools, roads, internet access, to everyone on Earth.
Trumka says what we now have instead are failed NAFTA-style trade policies that by design hurt workers across the world while enriching multinational corporations.
You see, NAFTA put corporations in charge of America's economic strategy with the goal of shipping jobs offshore to lower labor costs. The big trade deals since then used NAFTA as a starting blueprint, from the WTO to our bilateral relationship with China to the recent agreements with Korea and Colombia and Panama. The model is simply not working. It's not working here in the United States, and it's not working with most of our trading partners. And we have a lot of work to do to make this model work for working families, both in changing the rules and learning how to enforce them effectively. The model chronically starves the productive sector and working families while it fuels financial bubbles and busts, after which working people everywhere struggle to provide for themselves and for our families.
Supporting the Give America a Raise bus tour, New England organizer for the Alliance of Retired Americans, Jennifer Kinney, says that raising the minimum wage affects far more than just those working at that wage level.
The reason we would want to be involved with raising the wage is for several reasons, actually, because that absolutely ties in with retirement security. The more folks can earn during their work years, that they'll have higher Social Security when the time comes to retire.
The Give America a Raise bus tour is traveling to 18 cities in 11 states.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm trying to break out a really nice conversation with a Walmart worker who said, you know what, I'm all in support of raising the minimum wage. Also, I claim she listens to the program often, and that's a good thing. I think more Walmart employees should be listening to the program, organizing, you know, standing together, fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, all that stuff, a better future, and a better society. And I appreciate the call. Thanks so much. I saw this story over the weekend, caught my attention, that a Cambridge public school teacher, 25 years in the profession, has just had enough. Said, you know what, after 20 years in this particular district, 25 years as a teacher, this testing regime, these standardized tests, too much. It's a kindergarten teacher saying that the standardized, the mechanization of education, too much for her. And she is leaving the profession. And the sad thing is over the last couple of years where my kids go to school, I have seen good teachers heading for the door because of this mechanization, this industrial line, assembly line education process that's being thrown before us. Something that desperately, desperately needs to change, which is why we've asked our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, to come talk with us. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us. Would help if I turned the right microphone on. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here. How are you?
I am good. So, you know, what do you think of this? Here's a woman 25 years in the craft, 25 years as a professional, and just saying, you know what, I've had enough. I've grown angry. I've grown the passion is slipping away because every time I turn around, constricting.
Well, I've started to refer to this as the Gates syndrome, as in Bill Gates. I'm sure you, and I suspect a lot of our listeners, hear with great regularity how wonderful Bill and Melinda Gates have been to funding education and something that they call education reform. And their foundation, that is the wealthiest private foundation on the planet, has contributed a great deal of money to education. But unfortunately, it's a contribution that is not without strings. And the strings are really getting to the point, have gotten to the point indeed, Rick, where the strings are too costly to accept the money. Fundamentally, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, more than any other entity in the country, and maybe in the world, is responsible for this deprofessionalization of this wonderful profession of teaching. Teaching for more than two centuries here in North America has been a noble profession populated by people who are very, very deeply committed to the best that we have in our society, to our children, committed to teaching children not merely reading and writing and arithmetic, and that, of course, is so very important, but teaching children to have a thirst for knowledge, teaching children how to learn. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have pursued, and the country, since the adoption of this hocus-pocus, no child left behind baloney of the Bush administration imposed on us, have determined that everything can be measured, everything can be done by rote, everything can be determined based upon a test, and teaching is no longer a profession. Teaching, indeed, most of the time, can be accomplished by nothing more than a computer program with which the students would interface. And the most poignant evidence and development of all of that has been the cyber charter school, of which we have spoken many times in the past on this show, and this incessant testing, standardized testing, where the students are not given the opportunity to be creative, given the opportunity to think, given opportunities to apply the knowledge and information they've acquired to new problems and new situations and new foundations, but instead are required to regurgitate back this information on these standardized tests. And what's worse is our teachers and our schools are evaluated on the basis of how the kids perform on these tests without allowing for fundamental realities. The children learn at different paces. The children learn different ways. That children are not all mathematicians or wordsmiths. And children don't always demonstrate the caliber of their intellect on the basis of the outcomes of these very rote standardized tests. And how unfair is it to measure a teacher or a principal based upon how the students in a classroom do on this testing, particularly when the teacher, of course, and the principal, and none of our public schools, none of the school district-run schools in our state, get to determine which students are in which classrooms. Unlike the charter schools that engage in what I've called on this show, creaming, where they drive away applicants who are not going to be the best students. And by the way, on these standardized tests, the charter schools don't do any better than the school district-run schools. But setting that aside for the moment, the traditional school district schools, school district-run schools, don't get a chance to pick who's in Mrs. Jones's class. So Mrs. Jones is evaluated not on the basis of how she teaches, how well she teaches, but on the basis of how well the least well-equipped student in Mrs. Jones's class performs on these tests. Add to that the extraordinary expense of administering these tests, not merely because the tests themselves are very expensive, and indeed they are, and people like Bill Gates, who has an interest in the companies that make these tests, companies like the company that brings us the SAT, which they now seem to change in format every couple of years, all are printing money at taxpayer expense, but more significantly, at the expense of the education of our children, to pay for these tests. But on top of that, because the school administrators know that they're going to be evaluated based on how the students perform on the test, teachers are required not to teach reading and writing and arithmetic, and certainly not to teach art and music and humanities, and certainly are driven away from things like taking children to museums to learn about Native American history or paleontology or astronomy, but instead have to invest considerable time teaching the kids how to take the tests that the kids are going to have to take.
Yep. And, you know, they said it was only 12 hours of testing. 12 hours of testing. But I asked, how many hours go into preparing for those tests? Because I remember at the beginning of the year, we sat down at the first parent-teacher conference, and the teacher assured me that my daughter was doing just fine and that she would, and here it comes, she would pass the PSSA test. And, of course, my wife kicked me under the table because at that point I knew she wasn't taking the damn test anyway. Right. What did I care if she passed that test? I want her to be able to make change. I want her to be able to do math. I want her to be able to be a critical thinking human being, not just a bubble filler.
Mm-hmm. Well, and unfortunately, you can't blame or even be vaguely close to upset with the teacher.
And I'm not.
And because the poor teacher has been told by a department head, who in turn has been told by a principal, who in turn has been told by a superintendent, who in turn has been told by a school board, who in turn has been told by a political system in Harrisburg, that the measure by which we are going to fund your local school and Mrs. Smith's classroom is based upon how these kids are going to do on the Bill Gates test. Now be mindful that Bill Gates was trained in critical thinking. That's why he was able to create the largest new industry, not just company, but industry, on the planet in my lifetime, without having gone to college.
Well, don't you think that's part of the reason that people go, oh, well, look what he did there. Well, he could do wonders with education if he really wanted to.
Well, of course that is. He could do wonders, but what he really does is sell computers and sell software for those computers to ever enrich not only his foundation, but his personal fortune.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you this or then, because, you know, I've met people who are, they are true believers in this, especially the online stuff. When you get into the higher ed, and they are absolute true believers that this is this is the new wave of the future. They've discovered the latest, greatest way of doing this, and they truly, firmly believe that this is the best thing possible for the future of humanity.
Well, unfortunately, too many have taken up that mantle and carry that banner, and particularly at the university level, because universities are teaching these online courses, and instead of using professional academics who are trained professors who not only are expert in their field, but also are trained as educators, professional educators, instead the universities are hiring stringers, and they pay them very little, and they assign 100 online students to them instead of 30 classroom students to them. And the universities, of course, make a lot of money, because we not only know that university tuition, particularly here in the United States, is disproportionately higher and growing at a pace far in excess of inflation year after year after year, but these online courses are offered for the same dollar price per credit as classroom in bricks and mortar are offered. So universities are making a lot of money, particularly on courses that are the introductory or required courses for every curriculum. So you'll find that the people in the business school of University X conspire with the people in the liberal arts college, and they put in a requirement in business school that you have to have at least 12 credits of humanities, and the liberal arts college delivers on those humanities courses, and in return, the business college gets all of its majors to take a few of those liberal arts courses, and the liberal arts curriculum goes in the other direction and requires an accounting or quantitative business analysis or trigonometry course of all of their liberal arts majors, and everybody is making money, because what this is the corporatization of education. And we see it at every turn, and as bad as it is in elementary and secondary schools, it is on steroids in the post-secondary educational world. We are at a point now, and we even see it outside of the university level. The Anti-Union Contractors Association, the Associated Builders and Contractors, the ABC, now trains their apprentices online. How would you like to have your plumbing system?
No, that's not real.
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. The wheels of learning are online. And one day you're learning on the wheels, on the computer, to be a painter, and the next day installing black pipe that's going to carry natural gas in a building. Very, very
scary.
But welcome to the world. I used to think that those of us who have the good fortune and misfortune of living at this time were dealing with our generation's equivalent of the Industrial Revolution, our generation's equivalent of the mechanized society. And I thought that these upheavals must be somehow similar to the upheavals of the early 20th century, when automobiles started to be built not by hand, but on Henry Ford's assembly line, and people were trained to put the right front fender on. That was their job. Now I've reached a point where I see this as the startling, striking, frightening, dumbing down of society. Another chink in the armor, another peg in this dumbing down of America, where we will condemn people to a permanent underclass status, where they will not learn and they will not earn, because we have failed them. But they will have passed the standardized test. And every few years, when the schools that we so mechanize fail to meet the standards, well, we'll just change the standards. That's what we did in Pennsylvania last year. Used to be until last year, when they started this standardization of testing, schools had to make something called AYP, Average Yearly Progress, for the students in third grade, fifth grade, and ninth grade, etc. Now, we don't measure the success of schools by AYP. Why is that? Well, all of the charter schools and the cyber charter schools that the people who make up these testing measurement standards also want to fund in their endless, unquenchable thirst for privatization, were discovering that the charter schools weren't doing as well as the school district run schools on these tests, even after the charters had these impossible application forms where they had a 14-page long application and a requirement that both parents of a student attend at least two visits at the charter school during the application process on weekdays during normal working hours. So they kept people away that way. But even with that, they still weren't performing well enough on the AYP basis. So we got rid of the AYP. We have a new standard this year.
And we'll have another one, as you point out, in a couple of years. Or we'll just keep changing the names of the schools and the owners. It'll no longer be we the people owning our schools.
Well, it's already we the people not owning our schools, but it's still we the people funding our schools. And therein lies the rub. Most significant of all, of course, are these charters where somebody starts a charter school and they immediately create a so-called foundation that owns the building where the charter operates. The taxpayers give the charter money to educate students. The charter pays rent to the foundation, and at some point the taxpayers have paid for the building. But the rent doesn't stop. The rent goes on. When we pay for one of our school district buildings, after the bonds are liquidated, we own the building. When we pay for one of these foundation-operated, so-called foundation tax-exempt entities to buy and own the building, after the building is paid for, people start putting money in their pockets, and it's taxpayer money.
Or we fund other things, like extracurriculars, or we improve and do things that need to be done.
The cyber charter operators tell us that the taxpayer should pay for the tuition to go to the cyber charter school so a kid can sit at home on a computer monitor and hope that somebody's watching. But if the kid wants to play ball, they should be allowed to go back to the public school district at the public school district expense, in other words, at another taxpayer's expense, and participate in the school play or the band or the orchestra or the football team or the basketball team or the swimming team. And when somebody suggests that there's a problem with this, that the charter or cyber charter operator ought to reimburse the school district the cost of that, they say, oh, no, not us. We can't be compelled to do that. We don't get enough.
Amazing stuff. So last question, then. What do we do?
Same answer.
I always bring it back to this. What should we be doing?
We need to be engaged. I mean, particularly on this topic, more than others, and you and I, both on the air and off the air, have had more than one occasion to talk about this. There is no substitute for parents being activists in their kids' education and going to the school board meetings and speaking with the principal and speaking with the teachers and petitioning the superintendent and also making sure that at budget time we look at those budgets that the school district publishes and see what it is. And when we see an allocation of a ridiculous amount of money for standardized testing, don't be bashful. Speak out. And then, of course, do the same thing with our state legislators, our state representatives, and our state senators who are passing and debating the laws that impose many of these requirements and who are also the people who have the power of the purse strings with respect to how much the state invests in education, so that when Governor Corporate announces yet another repetition of his $1 billion a year cuts to education, that people speak out and tell their legislators that we have an expectation that they're going to fund this most basic of all things that we as Pennsylvanians and that our children are entitled to as a matter of the Constitution, certainly, but more importantly, as a matter of the fundamental morality of our society. So call, write, engage, talk, listen, interact, watch.
And scream and holler if you have to.
And scream and holler if you have to.
Erwin, always great talking with you. Appreciate you taking time for us.
Good to be here. Thanks, Rick. See you next week.
All righty. Our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackman.
We've been talking about military photographer Bill Jones and his end-of-war mission to photograph Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The officers accompanying him were energized by curiosity and sensed the importance of the mission. But the 20-year-old photographer said he didn't think about the significance of what he was doing at the time. He was just doing his job. Yet he did have some feel for the historical importance of what was going on just from being around the older officers. Enough so that he did something significantly different in his photo development procedures. He would move negatives through trays of fluids, a shortstop bath, removal of unexposed silver, and then add military data and information that included secret classification. But this time, he made himself a pre-official print to keep with no secret classification, then printed the official versions. Join us again for the classified photos. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
If one obscure college professor dies, does it make any difference? If you're Margaret Mary Voitko, yes. In life, she was just another adjunct teacher at Duquesne University, being grossly underpaid and maltreated by the school. Her story would be unknown, except for Daniel Kovalik. A lawyer with the United Steelworkers, Daniel knew Margaret Mary through his union's drive to help adjunct teachers organize for better pay and treatment. He wrote up her story, telling how Duquesne had paid her so little that she spiraled into abject poverty. Then they coldly booted her. No severance, no goodbyes. Impoverished, abandoned, scared, and stressed to the limit, her heart exploded shortly afterwards. Yet, in death, Margaret Mary is more alive than ever. Kovalik's poignant piece swept through the Internet, striking a chord with adjunct teachers everywhere. They see that their own low-wage position could put them in the same downward spiral it did for her. So Margaret Mary's story is being repeated all across the country, energizing organizing campaigns to empower and lift up these hard-hit university teachers. In a case of beautiful irony, one of their strongest campaigns is taking place at Duquesne. Adjuncts there have already voted to join the Steelworkers Union, but the domineering masters of this Catholic school are resorting to devious legalistic ploys to deny simple justice for their faculty. Bizarrely, they've even demanded a religious exemption from our labor laws, claiming that unionization would interfere with our teaching of Catholic values. This is Jim Hightower saying the Steelworkers Union president, Leo Gerard, has appealed that claim, not to the courts, but to the Pope. And to make his case that Pope Francis should speak out on this issue of social justice, Gerard told him the story of Margaret Mary Voitko. So in death, Margaret Mary even met the Pope.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
That's what you're going to have to learn to do, I think, in the coming years. Sleep with your eyes wide open and, you know, see what's going on around us. You know, I look at this education system that's being really forced on us. This is not, you know, for most of us, this is not I'm 46. This is not the system that I grew up in. You know, even people in their 30s, this is not the education that you got as a child. This is very much a highly structured, very narrowly focused, really highly stressful, very regimented existence for these kids. And you know, my oldest daughter, when she went through it to begin, she had a little struggle with it. Now my son is kind of like, oh, I don't care, you know, I'll do whatever, you know, I'm going to do my own thing anyway. And he is extremely bright, so he's able to not really get involved in other stuff and still pass through. But I worry about kids who, you know, they're not that. I worry about me, and I think about myself growing as a child, because I was not that focused. You know, I got beat a lot, so it brought me back into focus. But I learned more by doing, by having hands-on experience. And I look at this resignation letter written by this teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the Cambridge public school system there, just outside of Boston. This is a woman who, you know, 25 years, she was in the teaching profession and just had enough, you know, just trying to survive. But what she wrote is, she said, when I first began teaching more than 25 years ago, hands-on exploration, investigation, joy, and love of learning characterized the early childhood classroom. These are kindergartners, first, second grade. These are, you know, these are kids with very short attention spans. She goes on to write, I describe our current period as a time of testing, data collection, competition, and punishment. She said one would be hard-pressed these days to find joy present in classrooms. She says that she thought it started off with No Child Left Behind, you know, back during the Bush years. Over the years, she says she's seen this climate of data fascination seep into our schools and slowly change the ability for educators to teach creatively and respond to children's social and emotional needs. She says, but this was happening in most upper grades mostly. Then it came to kindergarten and pre-K. Beginning a number of years ago with literacy initiatives that would have had us spending the better time of each day teaching literacy skills through various prescribed techniques. She said, what math, science, creative expression, and play, what about that? The kindergarten teachers fought back and kept this push for an overload of literacy instruction at bay for a number of years. And, you know, I remember some of this as well going on. You know, you're trying to test these 4- and 5-year-olds who are, you know, now that you go back and you look at this stuff, because, you know, as parents first time around, you don't see this stuff coming. You're going, oh, well, these are the professionals. This is what they've done. This is a whole series, a whole system set up of learning and all. I'm finding out, and I have found out, that most of the teachers, this isn't how they were taught. This is the re-education of our educators. And over the last couple of years, there have been some really, and I think of the one fourth grade teacher my daughter had, who he was phenomenal. And he got out of it because the joy was gone every minute of every day. This is what you teach. It's almost like, here's the how-to, here's the idiot's guide, anyone can do it. And I look at this woman 25 years going, you know, I just can't take it anymore. There's no passion, the joy is gone, it's time to move on. And to be honest, this is what the profiteers want. This is what these folks want out of current educators. They want them to throw up their hands. They want to make it so difficult and so tedious that the good teachers leave. And then they can mechanize. And I'll tell you, it's angering on so many levels. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein. In response to a delay to the Affordable Care Act, Fox News began attacking the Obama administration, despite the similarities to delays by other presidents. On Fox's The Kelly File, host Megyn Kelly criticized the limited extension granted by the administration, saying,
"The end of March is supposed to be it. They were supposed to be very happy with the number of signups. It was all going great. The website was working perfectly. And now we get a report tonight. We're going to have another extension." Didn't they go to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend their mandate that people must have it and they have to be fined and it's a tax if they don't pay? Now it's, if you could just make them give us a promise ring, Supreme Court.
In reality, these types of administrative delays are nothing new. When former President George W. Bush was implementing Medicare Part D in 2006, the Bush administration also waived penalty fees for signing up late for Medicare drug coverage. While this delay is almost the same situation, Fox still used it as an opportunity to smear the Affordable Care Act and the Obama administration. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. There you can get the podcast if you missed any portion of the program. You can also watch the video, the YouTube video, as we stream live video from here in the studio. You can look at me waving my arms around, looking all that silly. Because I talk with my hands, and I don't do the big ball, little ball thing. Like they teach you in media training. Big ball, little ball. I'm all over the place. Crazy. Because this stuff is maddening. I mean, you've got to look at this stuff. And I don't know any other response than anger and the want to get out and do something about it. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. I see this story from Kansas, where the Republicans in Kansas, their General Assembly has put the nicks on a proposal that would make all-day kindergarten available to every student in the state of Kansas. Now, the senator there, the former senator, current governor, Sam Brownback, as I call him, Brownback Mountain, he wants it. It's election year. Got to have something the people want. People want full-day kindergarten because they understand more time for kids to learn, more interaction, good stuff. As long as it's not more of, here's a bubble, fill that in. Now, according to the House Speaker of the Kansas House there, Ray Merrick, he said that, now it's not the year for it. It's just not going to happen. Because, you know, you're going to compel, you know, schools across the state to do this. It's just too much money. We don't have it. But what the real reason is, as some of the folks, some of the Republicans there in Kansas have pointed out, is that, well, you know, those people, those poor people, they're just going to end up abusing it, right? You know, they're just not going to be able to take advantage of it. They're just going to abuse it, right? They're going to abuse it much like they, you know, abuse, you know, food. And they're going to abuse it just like they, you know, anything else. And what I find really interesting is, you know, they're saying that, you know, those poor people just use it as babysitting. You know that, right? And I look at this and I go, you know, wait a second. Hold on. That's actually not a bad thing, is it? Is it not a bad thing that kids are in school getting some form of education while their parents are at work instead of being warehoused to say, here, go sit in this room? What the hell does this have to, what does this say about the Republican Party of this country where their main argument against giving young kids like my kids an opportunity at full day daycare or universal pre-K or any of the things that my kids have benefited from solely because I have the economic resources to be able to get that for them, where a good number of people in this country do not. And I guess I could take the position, the very conservative, right-wing, holier-than-thou Republican position that, well, you know what? I can afford it. My kids, they should get the advantage. My kids should have the advantage because I can afford it for them. And all those other kids, the heck with them. And it's this mentality that there's only one spot at the top, and it's going to be my kid because I can afford it, and we'll crush all the other ones. And I'm of the mindset there's more than one spot up there. As a nation, we grow together. As a nation, we all do better together. And if we allow some people to falter and fall behind, you end up with a nation that is struggling. But I find it just incredible that the people who tell me they believe in God and they're good, God-fearing Christian people, that this is the kind of garbage and filth and rhetoric that comes out of their mouths. But worse yet, it's what's on their minds. It's what they believe. That's what scares me. It's the people who tell me they believe. You know what? It's what they believe that scares me. And when you're saying to me when I was a kid that, hey, you don't get kindergarten, you don't get pre-K, you don't get the advantages that everybody else gets just because you're poor, that, I got to tell you, sends a powerful message to me. And it should send to everyone else because at the end of the day, I don't know where you're at in your life, but any one of us are a couple of paychecks, an illness to our kids away from being in that position. It's just, well, it's just shocking to me. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Quick break, right back with Hour 2. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, from the talk. I see them blue.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a major speech on trade policy at the Center for American Progress Tuesday, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka called for a global New Deal and trade policies designed to create a virtuous cycle for working people worldwide.
We need new policies to spark a virtuous cycle where rising wages fuel demand, not flimsy, debt-driven demand, but healthy demand, which in turn spark business investment and more jobs and higher wages in a strong cycle of global growth that works for all our families, for the environment, and for our communities. We need a global New Deal, a worldwide program to bring the basic infrastructure of modern society, electricity, water, schools, roads, internet access to everyone on Earth.
Trumkus says what we now have instead are failed NAFTA-style trade policies that by design hurt workers across the world while enriching multinational corporations.
You see, NAFTA put corporations in charge of America's economic strategy with the goal of shipping jobs offshore to lower labor costs. The big trade deals since then used NAFTA as a starting blueprint, from the WTO to our bilateral relationship with China to the recent agreements with Korea and Colombia and Panama. The model is simply not working. It's not working here in the United States, and it's not working with most of our trading partners. And we have a lot of work to do to make this model work for working families, both in changing the rules and learning how to enforce them effectively. The model chronically starves the productive sector and working families while it fuels financial bubbles and busts, after which working people everywhere struggle to provide for themselves and for our families.
Supporting the Give America a Raise bus tour, New England organizer for the Alliance of Retired Americans, Jennifer Kinney, says that raising the minimum wage affects far more than just those working at that wage level.
The reason we would want to be involved with raising the wage is for several reasons, actually, because that absolutely ties in with retirement security. The more folks can earn during their work years, that they'll have higher Social Security when the time comes to retire.
The Give America a Raise bus tour is traveling to 18 cities in 11 states.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, waiting for the hammer to fall. And I got to be honest with you, the more of these stories that I hear of state officials taking gifts and state officials, you know, lining their pockets, you see the representative in Philadelphia being arrested and or being charged with bribery. You see a whole bunch of this stuff going on. It wasn't bribery. It was using her campaign staff or her staff to do campaign work and other stuff. But you see this stuff, and it just makes you go, where do these people get the idea that they're going to get away with it? And if these are the people that are getting caught, how many folks are actually getting away with it? Which is why we've asked Barry Kaufman. He's the executive director of Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Barry's name. Barry, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for inviting me to be with you this evening.
You know, I look at these stories, and we see them every so often popping up where, you know, there were gifts. Clarence Thomas, to me, was a perfect example of, you know, his wife got a bust of, I forget who it was, and they got all these gifts and all of this stuff. And you go, explain to me how it is the governor of Virginia, for instance, gifts and money. Where do these people get off thinking they're not going to get caught?
Well, you know, it's the arrogance is sometimes just absolutely astounding. That they do think about this, and even in some cases, they're claimed to be working in the legislature to stop these kind of activities. At the same time, they're actually doing them themselves.
So, you know, I look at the most recent one. Someone had sent me an email with a story about some of the people at the Liquor Control Board. A couple of them have gotten caught for taking gifts, and I'm going, you know, it can't be that pervasive that there are that many people doing it. And I guess I'm glad that I'm hearing people are getting caught, because I guess if you don't hear about it, it doesn't mean it's stopped. It just means we're not looking for it.
Right.
But at some point, it's maddening, and it gives the anti-government people a lot of fodder and a lot of ammunition to go, see, we should be privatizing this stuff.
Right. I mean, and that is the sad outcome is, you know, when we keep hearing this endless litany, week after week there seems to be, you know, a new allegation or a new indictment. And, you know, it is actually very harmful to the basic foundation of our democracy, because democracy is based on citizens' confidence. And when citizens lose confidence in the integrity of the government, it begins to crumble. That's why we desperately need to do what, I guess, several things. We desperately need to have campaign contribution limits like 39 other states and the federal government have. But we desperately need to have a gift ban on gifts so that everybody knows what the rules are and you know what is permitted and what's not permitted. So, Pennsylvania tends to be, unfortunately, at the end of the ethics parade on so many issues. In 2006, after more than two decades of fighting, we did actually get a pretty good lobbyist disclosure law. It took us from the absolute bottom of the barrel for lobbyist disclosure in the nation to probably being in the top third. But even that law that we passed in 2006 had one gaping hole in it, and that was the fact that it did not limit or ban the gifts to public officials, nor did it require disclosure for gifts that are permitted.
Well, explain to me how this works, Barry, because, you know, I know a lot of politicians. I know and there are a lot of very good people that I know. And, you know, you wonder how that you get sucked into this, how it is that good people go, and is it the system? You know, how do you end up getting in these situations? Because, you know, you go into it going, I'm not going to take gifts. Lobbyists aren't going to get. How do you move into this?
Well, you know, you're right. I think, you know, almost every legislator I've ever met comes to Harrisburg with that Mr. Smith goes to Washington attitude that I know I'm going to be a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout, and I'm going to do good for the people. But the system itself, especially in Pennsylvania, just slowly, you know, chews up the integrity in far too many cases and leads people into, you know, thinking that, you know, wrongful behavior is acceptable or that they won't get caught. The system in Pennsylvania, because it is so lax, does leave people into temptation. That's why we do need to establish laws like many other states to take government integrity seriously. We need the same kind of laws in Pennsylvania, which would restrict those kind of behaviors. And also, we need strong enforcement. You know, in some cases, what we saw lately was already illegal. I mean, you know, we saw the senator from Philadelphia doing. It's already illegal to use, has been for a long time, to use your office, your state-paid staff for campaign political activities.
Right.
Strong enforcement is critical. And I think what we need to do, another critical element of what we need to do is, you know, we need to reinvigorate this sense with all the elected officials that, you know, they're being shamed as well. You know, they're being painted by the same brush by the bad actors. And we need the good folks within the legislature and within our local government to stand up and say, hey, you know, this is not good for me. This is not good for our government. And, you know, I'm going to stand up on behalf of the people, and I'm not going to let the bad guys get away with it.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, that's such an important point, because what ends up happening is that you get that, oh, they're all crooks.
Uh-huh.
And they all do it, and, you know, that whole everyone does it mentality. And I don't know if everyone does it or not, but that's the meme that's thrown out there. And I think you're absolutely right. When one person gets caught or gets in trouble, then it casts dispersion on the rest of them. So you would think that they would want to pass something very, very open, very transparent, stringent, so that people would say, you know what, they're being held to a higher standard than the average person.
Sure. I mean, with regard to gifts, my data is a little bit old, but when we last did a check, there were at least 15 states which just banned people giving gifts to elected officials.
Like, what kind of gifts are we talking about?
Everything.
Not like just like a birthday present here, here's a cupcake.
Not a cup of coffee. So, I mean, in some states, you know, like Wisconsin and Kentucky and some other states, you can't give them anything. And that's really the way it should be. You know, if you want to make a pitch to an elected official like your state legislator, your state senator, or even your township supervisor, the only thing you really should need to take with you is a good argument and maybe some documents to back up your argument. You shouldn't need to be, you know, taking them to dinners or, in some cases, taking them on a private jet to the Super Bowl. That just simply should not be permitted. And, you know, the only reason that, you know, lobbyists, and most lobbyists are actually pretty smart people, and the people that hire them from big corporations are pretty smart people, too. And, you know, if this giving of gifts and hospitality and entertainment and lodging and travel, you know, if it wasn't working, I guarantee it would stop pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the American Legislative Exchange Council. They've basically grown up around this idea that you bring these people and their family to these exclusive resorts, and then you hand them model legislation, and you don't think somehow there's going to be some quid pro quo there.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they have a new organization, I think it's called ACE. The American Legislative Exchange Council is where all the big corporations get together and create model legislation, and then they bring state legislators down for these big junkets in, you know, in huge resorts, and they treat them well, and then they develop legislative strategies to get, you know, things passed, like the Trayvon Martin Stand Your Ground Bill, which, you know, is really a pretty sinister kind of law, and some other things like the voter ID law, which, you know, unfortunately, most Pennsylvanians still think it's a good idea because they don't understand its real dangerous impact, that it could, in fact, you know, disenfranchise as many as somewhere between 300,000. We know it would disenfranchise at least 90,000, but it could be well over a million voters simply because they don't have the kind of identification most of us have. I know the people who think that, you know, voter ID in voting is not a big deal are people who already had voter's license and driver's licenses. But there are a lot of people who don't.
Yeah, and while that was all going on, I had come across one of those people.
Sure.
And I said, hey, well, give me your license and give me your voter registration card. And oddly enough, they were different.
Right.
And I said, you, my friend, would be precluded from voting.
Yeah, there was even a state senator whose license didn't match, you know, his other identification or his name on his voter registration. So there are a lot of people out there in these categories, you know, especially people living in urban areas, especially people who are elderly that might be living in a nursing home and don't drive anymore, a retirement center, young people who still live with parents, maybe don't drive. So there are tens of thousands, if not as many as a million people in the state who are legitimately registered, entitled to vote as citizens of the state, but cannot produce the kind of registration that, the kind of identification that would be required to vote. And, you know, the scenario which is always raised in cases, well, everybody has ID. You know, you have to have ID to, go to the bank, go to the hospital, or things like that. But you have to remember the banking industry in this country writes off, you know, $1 billion or more every year in business expenses for, you know, inappropriate transactions that are done electronically.
Right.
So, voting is a guaranteed right under the state constitution.
Yeah, I mean, you hear the nonsense. I need a driver's license to rent a car. I need a driver's license to stay in a hotel. And I go, true, but you don't have a constitutional right to those things.
Sure, I mean, but voting is sacred. I mean, voting is the only way that most people in this country interact with their government. And, you know, it's the only way, in most cases, that they have of holding power accountable, of holding their public officials accountable for their actions, for making changes when they don't think it's right.
Right. For me, it's the ultimate term limit.
Absolutely. Because, think about it. When we have these kind of situations, voting is the way we respond to citizens.
So as I look at this, Barry, and, you know, for me, it all comes back down to the very simple reality that it's the money. I mean, it's the money in our politics. It's whether it's gifts, whether it's cash, whether it's campaign money, whether it's any of this stuff, it comes down to the money. And then shouldn't we be talking on some level about maybe publicly financed elections and just ban all of it?
Well, I think that would be the ultimate goal, because you get what you pay for, you know. The oil and gas industry that, you know, ran through the legislature with fracking, and we're now discovering no groundwater being poisoned. People can't use their water at all. They have to have water shipped in. That's down our streams, going into the aquifers. You know, it was money, campaign contributions, that allowed them to roll that through the legislature. You know, they were prepared ahead of time. Cozied up with many of the key leaders, and you know, when time came, they were just able to roll things right through. You know, get access to all the state parks and lands, and game lands for drilling. They got reduced oversight in regulatory affairs, and they really pretty much got everything right. I mean, let's face it, we're the only state in the nation that doesn't have a severance tax.
Yeah, we're pulling West Virginia down.
Right.
And look at it from a business standpoint. A couple of $1,000 to a politician when you can get millions in response is a huge, it's a good investment. When you can give Governor Corbett $1 million for his campaign, because it's legal, you can do it,
right.
And he's going to say, we're not going to tax you, and you can save hundreds of millions, that's a really good investment. And
you,
I keep asking, how do I get that investment?
You can't get a return on investment anywhere in Wall Street like that, unless you're one of the Wall Street bankers yourself. But I think you raised three critical points, and that is the fact that money does control. If it doesn't, buy you a guaranteed result with a politician, it definitely guarantees you access at the critical times when you need access.
Yep.
To a politician. So, I mean, the three things which we must accomplish in Pennsylvania, and do it soon. We must get contribution limits. We absolutely have to turn down the spigot so that regular people's votes are actually meaningful. Right now we have a system whereby elected officials have two constituencies. They have the voting constituency, the people like all of us that go in and vote twice a year, hopefully twice a year, and then they have a funding constituency. And it's the funding constituency that keeps them in office. So the funding constituency definitely trumps the voting constituency in those cases. So we definitely need contribution limits. Number two, we definitely have to fix the redistricting system, because the way we redistrict our districts, our legislative districts every 10 years, pretty much guarantees that all but maybe a dozen of legislative districts in Pennsylvania are non-competitive.
Right.
One party will definitely win, and the party bosses in those districts will guarantee that the incumbent will almost always win. And if there's not an incumbent running, they will hand select the successor. And number three, we definitely have to get a handle on the gifts issue. The gifts, the hospitality, entertainment, lodging. We cannot permit lobbyists, those who hire lobbyists, government contractors, and others who are seeking favors from our elected officials and from our administrators in state government. We cannot allow them to develop these special relationships with which they can cash in and skew the judgment of those public officials.
I'm right there with you. And also close. I would add in there, close the swinging door to where they go off into the corporate world and then find their way back and all of those things as well. But aside from going to commoncause.org and going to your website, what should we be doing to push this stuff? Last question.
Well, I think we are at a critical juncture right now. The legislature, I think, is embarrassed by all the things that are going on.
As it should be.
Week after week, month after month. I think we have hit a critical mass where, like after the pay raise, they know something has to be done. So I think the public's got to go to their lawmakers and say, hey, we've had enough. Fix this system. We want integrity of our government. We want to make sure the decisions of our government officials are based on facts and critical thinking, and instead of relationships with lobbyists and others.
I'm right there with you. Of course, the website, commoncause.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Barry Coffin's name. Take you right there. He is the executive director of Common Cause. Barry, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
I bet. You bet. Thanks for the invitation.
Anytime. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah. proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein. In response to a delay to the Affordable Care Act, Fox News began attacking the Obama administration, despite the similarities to delays by other presidents. On Fox's The Kelly File, host Megyn Kelly criticized the limited extension granted by the administration, saying,
"The end of March is supposed to be it. They were supposed to be very happy with the number of signups. It was all going great. The website was working perfectly. And now we get a report tonight, we're going to have another extension." Didn't they go to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend their mandate that people must have it and they have to be fined and it's a tax if they don't pay? Now it's, if you could just make them give us a promise ring, Supreme Court.
In reality, these types of administrative delays are nothing new. When former President George W. Bush was implementing Medicare Part D in 2006, the Bush administration also waived penalty fees for signing up late for Medicare drug coverage. While this delay is almost the same situation, Fox still used it as an opportunity to smear the Affordable Care Act and the Obama administration. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
If one obscure college professor dies, does it make any difference? If you're Margaret Mary Voitko, yes. In life, she was just another adjunct teacher at Duquesne University, being grossly underpaid and maltreated by the school. Her story would be unknown, except for Daniel Kovalik. A lawyer with the United Steelworkers, Daniel knew Margaret Mary through his union's drive to help adjunct teachers organize for better pay and treatment. He wrote up her story, telling how Duquesne had paid her so little that she spiraled into abject poverty. Then they coldly booted her. No severance, no goodbyes. Impoverished, abandoned, scared, and stressed to the limit, her heart exploded shortly afterwards. Yet, in death, Margaret Mary is more alive than ever. Kovalik's poignant piece swept through the Internet, striking a chord with adjunct teachers everywhere. They see that their own low-wage position could put them in the same downward spiral it did for her. So Margaret Mary's story is being repeated all across the country, energizing organizing campaigns to empower and lift up these hard-hit university teachers. In a case of beautiful irony, one of their strongest campaigns is taking place at Duquesne. Adjuncts there have already voted to join the Steelworkers Union, but the domineering masters of this Catholic school are resorting to devious legalistic ploys to deny simple justice for their faculty. Bizarrely, they've even demanded a religious exemption from our labor laws, claiming that unionization would interfere with our teaching of Catholic values. This is Jim Hightower saying the Steelworkers Union president, Leo Gerard, has appealed that claim, not to the courts, but to the Pope. And to make his case that Pope Francis should speak out on this issue of social justice, Gerard told him the story of Margaret Mary Voitko. So in death, Margaret Mary even met the Pope.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I look at this Hobby Lobby thing, and it's one of those, it's so crystal clear to me, so crystal clear. This is not, and I don't care how far the right wing keeps throwing this, how far they keep, oh, this is about my religion. It's not about your religion. It has nothing to do with your religion. Your religion would be infringed if I said you have to take it, and I'm going to ram it down your throat. That would be kind of against your religion. Just a thought. My problem with this, and it's been my problem from the beginning, I have not changed on this, because my original view of this is accurate then as it is now. This is an employment issue. We have given employers way too much power. We have given them too much power over our society. We have given them too much power over our families. We have given them too much power over our lives. We have given them too much power over the nation. We have given them just far too much power. This is why, and look, we can argue back and forth. This is why you absolutely have to have a strong, powerful labor movement. with at least somewhat close to equal standing. You cannot, and I love these people who say, oh, we're gonna negotiate. Who exactly are you going to negotiate with? When they are telling you, we're not going to provide you with some bit of care that you want in your health care package, that you would pay for, because understand, and this is the part that gets me, people, the health care that you get from your employer, that they're so quote-unquote providing, you're paying for. It's called deferred compensation. And I love people who say, well, you know, the employer gives us these wonderful things. No, they don't. It's all part of your wage package. If they weren't giving you the health care, if that weren't part of it, your wages would be higher. And I've always argued that I don't know whose bright idea it was to make health care dependent on employment, but it's not very bright. Especially if you're in a situation where you're underemployed. Especially in a situation like 2008, where we had a massive collapse. Randall points out, Randall sent me an email during the break, points out that now prospective employees have to give their employers their Facebook passwords. The employers want it. We want your password. Last time, as Randall points out, that's Facebook. It's private, right? But you wouldn't know it from what most people post on it. But here's the thing that gets me. They want your passwords. They want all of your personal information. They're following you. You want to talk about stalking? That, my friends, that is stalking. And I have, you know, I do weekend work occasionally where I've done a couple of different applications. Now understand, the last application I have filled out for a job was some 20 years ago. So the world has completely changed in the world of filling out applications and jumping through hoops. I'm now finding that, oh my goodness, tons of individuals' free time is being spent jumping through hoops for the employer to hire them. Taking online tests at their own time, 4 or 5 hours, going and doing physicals on their own time, and training on their own time, and all of this stuff at the employer's behest, just non-compensated. And it's just remarkable to me what we've allowed employers to get away with. And this healthcare issue is that next extension. We've given everything else. We've given them the ability to dictate everything else. And now they want what kind of care we get for our families. To me, I don't care what your religious belief is. The fact that someone else wants to intrude on you and your family's life and health should send people screaming to the streets, demanding our political class to say, hey, you know what? This is flat wrong. And I don't care what kind of kook at Hobby Lobby or whatever, Conestoga or Cumberland or whatever the heck it is. I don't care what those kooks want. They're not job creators. They're people who are figuring out how to make themselves more money. And until we start thinking back in terms of our families, we're gonna have a lot of trouble. Which is why I keep saying, and I go back to this time and time again, that we absolutely, positively, without question, need to have a reinvigorated, strong labor movement of individuals, of you and me, the rest of us standing shoulder to shoulder, saying, you know what, enough already, no more. We're not going to allow them to dictate what health care we get. They're not going to be able to dictate the conditions under which I provide for my family. I'm going to leave you with one last thought. Our National Labor Relations Act, the thing that the right wing goes nuts about, because that NLRB, because the National Labor Relations Act created the board. The original National Labor Relations Act gives not one right, grants not one single word of one bit of a right to employers. And here's why. Because when they wrote the law, they fully understood, completely cognizant of the reality that employers have all the rights. And that this one act, this one piece of legislation, gave workers some bit of dignity, some bit of rights. And they're trying to steal that away. And this Hobby Lobby case, just another example of that. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a major speech on trade policy at the Center for American Progress Tuesday, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka called for a global New Deal and trade policies designed to create a virtuous cycle for working people worldwide.
We need new policies to spark a virtuous cycle where rising wages fuel demand, not flimsy, debt-driven demand, but healthy demand, which in turn spark business investment and more jobs and higher wages in a strong cycle of global growth that works for all our families, for the environment, and for our communities. We need a global New Deal, a worldwide program to bring the basic infrastructure of modern society, electricity, water, schools, roads, internet access, to everyone on Earth.
Trumka says what we now have instead are failed NAFTA-style trade policies that by design hurt workers across the world while enriching multinational corporations.
You see, NAFTA put corporations in charge of America's economic strategy with the goal of shipping jobs offshore to lower labor costs. The big trade deals since then used NAFTA as a starting blueprint, from the WTO to our bilateral relationship with China to the recent agreements with Korea and Colombia and Panama. The model is simply not working. It's not working here in the United States, and it's not working with most of our trading partners. And we have a lot of work to do to make this model work for working families, both in changing the rules and learning how to enforce them effectively. The model chronically starves the productive sector and working families while it fuels financial bubbles and busts, after which working people everywhere struggle to provide for themselves and for our families.
Supporting the Give America a Raise bus tour, New England organizer for the Alliance of Retired Americans, Jennifer Kinney, says that raising the minimum wage affects far more than just those working at that wage level.
The reason we would want to be involved with raising the wage is for several reasons, actually, because that absolutely ties in with retirement security. The more folks can earn during their work years, that they'll have higher Social Security when the time comes to retire.
The Give America a Raise bus tour is traveling to 18 cities in 11 states.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. So you may remember, just a little over 3 years ago, we were in Wisconsin, sleeping on the Capitol floor there as Scott Walker was attacking workers' rights in Wisconsin. I remember saying, look, folks, we're here in Wisconsin, sleeping in this cold Capitol on the granite floor, so that we could begin the organizing process, because we know these attacks are going to move from Wisconsin across Ohio, across Tennessee, Missouri. They're going to find their way to Pennsylvania. And they did. Out of Wisconsin to Michigan to Ohio to Tennessee, Missouri, all across this country. And here they are right now. And I remember saying, look, this isn't just isolated incidences. This is a concerted effort by the very well-to-do, not just here in the U.S., but globally. This is an assault on workers, not just here in the U.S., but all over the world. And when we see attacks on workers in Cambridge, Massachusetts, there are attacks on workers in Cambridge over across the pond, which is why we've asked Andrew Brady. He's with Union Solidarity International, USILive.org is their website. Andrew, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, absolute pleasure to join you, brother, and to have the opportunity to speak to your massive and growing audience, so thanks very much.
You know, it's great that when I saw you were here in the U.S. and you were doing a tour talking to different people on how we can grow global solidarity, I go, I got to get Andrew on the program. So I appreciate you taking a little bit of time out of your busy schedule over these next couple of days. So let me ask you, what are you doing here in the U.S. now?
Well, Rick, I'm actually in D.C. at the moment, and I've been meeting with a number of unions, including the Amalgamated Transit Union, Unite here. And tomorrow I'll be traveling on to Philadelphia to do an open conversation to speak with brothers and sisters here about the struggles that they are facing. And as you quite correctly identified, Rick, about how brothers and sisters all over the world are facing the same challenges, and often by the same companies and individuals. So it's about how we can connect more meaningfully with each other and actually deepen the layers of solidarity. And there's many opportunities to do that as a result of technology, social media, but also, Rick, what I think is equally important, as we've discovered over the last couple of months, how we can develop our own private spheres of organizing and communicating, because I think that's a very important part of our challenge going forward, about not only can we use the current modes of communication, but how can we develop our own privately and securely to fight back against the casino capitalism that has wreaked havoc across our world, my friend.
Now, that's a good way of putting it, casino capitalism, because it's basically the high rollers are the ones who are walking away with all of the winnings, while the rest of us, we're left sweeping up the what's left over.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a phrase that's being used across the world, of course. It's not just applicable, as I said, in North America, but across Europe and beyond, whereby those who have created the problem have actually nationalized the debts, and, you know, it's the middle class, it's the working class, it's the people trying to make their way in the world. Honestly, they're having to foot the bill for the absolute havoc that has been caused by those who have been rolling the dice irresponsibly. So it's up to us as a movement to be more coordinated, to use all the mediums that we have at our disposal to try and communicate and connect with each other to optimize the chances of success, Rick. That's all we can do. We can just give it our best shot and to fight back, because the honest truth is, as I'm sure many people in America know, that unless you fight back, you don't win. And you might not win all the time, but, you know, if you don't connect and link up with other workers, grassroots organizations, we've got no hope in fighting back. And what I'm doing in America, Rick, is about how we can extend that, not only within a national jurisdiction, but how we can actually do that across the world, and how we can actually fight back against some of the individuals and corporations that don't believe that there's such a thing as health and safety, don't believe in such a thing as a minimum wage, never mind a living wage. And we've got to fight and connect with each other to give us the best chances of trying to get the wins that working people deserve.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, and it's part of the things that we talk about in this program quite often. But, you know, what we have, Andrew, is this divide, this national divide, where these global corporations do a remarkable job of slicing and dicing us up you know, just here in this country, between regions of our country, between ethnicities, between gender, between class, all of this, they slice us and dice us really nicely here. But globally, they do a masterful, even more masterful job of pitting us against worker over national boundaries. That, I think, is a huge hurdle that we're going to have to figure out how to bridge, because the multinational corporations, they've figured it out. They just go and they buy everything up.
No, you're absolutely right. It is the challenge of our age for our movement, and it's about how to be truthful, Rick. It's about how we can link up with labor union members across the world to help them fight in their own domestic countries for better terms and conditions, because that is the only way that you stop exploitation. That is the only way that you stop privatization and outsourcing. There is no other way, Rick, that you can prevent these things, in all honesty, other than helping labor union members across the world fight back within their workplaces, within their companies, and within the localities that they are. So instead of this race to the bottom that we are seeing all over the world, that we actually put an end to that and actually try and drive up the terms and conditions of workers all around the world. Because unless you do that, you're absolutely correct. The slicing and dicing, the playing state off of states, North and South in America, or, you know, countries in Europe against countries in North America, you know, the old classic maxim of, you know, dividing people and conquer will prevail. And the only opportunity that we've got to fight back against this is if we link up, we share information, we share campaigns, and we coordinate where we can to raise awareness and to apply pressure and leverage on companies, on governments that have no intention other than to drive down terms and conditions. Let's not underestimate the challenge here. It's absolutely massive, but we have got to fight back with all the means at our disposal. And we can do this, Rick, I mean, to a large extent by using some of the social media and technology that we've had at our disposal. I'm sure many of your listeners will be absolutely interested to hear what's going on in countries like Turkey at the moment, whereby the government is actually clamping down on people trying to fight back and organise and banning Twitter in that country.
Yeah.
So there is the opportunity to use some of these social media and technology streams to connect workers domestically and across continents to apply pressure, to turn the pressure up and to turn the temperature up on not only companies, right, but governments. It is our only hope. And I think there is the chance that this can prevail in time if, and this is a big if, but I think it can be done, we coordinate and we connect with workers, not only domestically, but around the world, on an issue-by-issue basis and on a company-by-company basis, where we can pool our resources and apply the maximum amount of pressure to try and change the direction of companies and governments.
I'm right there with you. And for me, it comes, a big portion of that comes to our trade policies, not just here, but across the world.
Sure.
These insane trade policies that I got to be honest, I don't see the trade policies that we've been pursuing for the last 20 odd years in this country that has benefited any working person anywhere around the world. So when you look at it from the frame that I just don't see any benefit to workers anywhere. To then saying this trade regime, this neoliberal trade policy that we've been pursuing has benefited nobody who works. We should be scrapping the whole thing and pursuing a model of fair trade where we can all benefit from it.
No, you're absolutely correct. You wouldn't be surprised to hear me say that. And this is something that we've covered extensively on USILive.org, of course, the transatlantic trade partnerships, the ones that are going on in the Pacific as well, and in many respects could be described as a corporate coup, and it's been done by stealth, right, because the general population don't know what's going on, and they don't know what's going on deliberately, because governments and companies who are hell-bent on pursuing a neoliberal policy don't want the population to know. They don't want the population to know about another NAFTA, do they, where hundreds of thousands of jobs were lost as a result of trade policies? So it's about how we can, on an issue like trade, raise awareness in countries around the world about the very real and negative implications that will happen to you on your shop floor, on your factory floor, and for communities if you allow these things to go unchecked. And that is what is happening. And it's happening not by default, but by design, because corporations and governments around the world don't want workers and communities to know about the negative and malign impacts of these trade policies. And so that's also another reason why you've got to connect with trade unions, labour members, progressives around the world, so that we are raising awareness about the impacts of these policies and are applying pressure on the politicians, elected representatives, to say, this is just not on. We are not signing off hundreds of thousands of jobs being outsourced and the dilution of terms and conditions.
You know, you brought up the idea of we've got to learn this stuff. We've got to get the information. Here in the U.S., I'm sure you know, the vast majority of our media is controlled by huge conglomerates. The statistic I saw, 80% of everything we see, hear, and read owned by six multinational corporations. Is that something that's unique to the United States, or do you see that in more countries around the world as these big corporations move around the world?
Rick, this is not an isolated case. When you in your opening comments introducing myself spoke about wealthy individuals and corporations, often they are the same wealthy individuals and corporations operating around the world, such as Rupert Murdoch, for example. You know how influential he is within the mainstream media within the UK. And in many respects, Rick, within the UK, it is a mirror image of what is going on in America, whereby three or four wealthy individuals and families own 80% of the publishing press. Now, that has an absolutely substantial impact on the general population, who are getting drip-drip fed the mantra of austerity, of neoliberal policies. And what we've got to do, Rick, and this is why your show is so important, this is why I think USI Live is so important, and to be honest, why we need more Rick Smiths, why we need more USIs, because the scale of the challenge is massive, because we are fighting against absolutely massive organisations, and we have got no hope in hell of ever being given a fair crack of the whip within the mainstream media. So what do we need to do, Rick? We need to develop our own ways of communicating with Labour union members and progressives around the world. We cannot rely on being given a few lines or column inches and an article of one of the mainstream media outlets. We've got to develop our own ways of communicating with progressives and labour union members, and we've got to do it also, Rick, privately and securely, so that we are not compromised by what some of the major social media and telecommunications companies have been doing in relation to NSA and the GCHQ in the UK. We've also got to develop our own ways of privately communicating, because there is no doubt, Rick, when these companies and corporations are passing on information, who are they coming after? They're coming after labour union members, they're coming after labour activists who are fighting against the status quo. Mm-hmm. So we've got to develop, as I say, our own ways of communicating with each other, not only domestically, but around the world. It's about how we deepen the layers of solidarity, Rick.
What's amazing to me, Andrew, is, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I remember stories from my grandfather and from older generations who said, you know, back in the teens, in the 20s here in the U.S., they had to go have union meetings under railroad bridges at midnight in the cloak of darkness so no one could see them and they could be in secret. And we're talking about doing the exact same thing today, only digitally.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree anymore. And that's why we have got to think outside the box, Rick. We have got to, as I said, create our own private spheres of communicating with each other. And that's why it's so important that we are also communicating in a diverse way such as your show, such as USI Live, that we are developing our own ways of communicating with our people, unfiltered by what the Rupert Murdochs and the Koch brothers of this world want to absolutely censor the population hearing the truth and hearing the facts. And that's why we've got to work with each other. And that's why we've had a relationship for a while as well, Rick, that we are also not doing this alone, Rick. And this is such an important point, I think.
Yep.
There is nobody that can do this alone. We have got to link up strategically with like-minded organizations, pool our resources, and give us the opportunity of optimizing success and having a reservoir of people that we can rely on and can mobilize, not through mainstream media, but by ourselves.
Now, we've got to develop our own, much like my grandparents' generation did after World War II, and I'm sure in the UK they did as well. After World War II, they built this huge middle class that has been destroyed by our billionaire class, which is why things like USILive.org is so important. And I appreciate the work that you're doing, and I know you've got a busy day ahead. I appreciate you taking a couple of minutes for us to tell us what you're doing. And please, we'd love to have you come back again real soon, Andrew.
Rick, really appreciate the invitation to not only speak to your good self, but your audience. And let me just conclude by saying that it's a real honor to be invited on your show. You are one of the inspirations for our movement. I just don't say that to eulogize and give you a big head and boost your ego. It is the truth. We need more people like you in our world and in our movement, Rick. And, you know, we look forward to working with you and your audience to strengthen not only solidarity in the United States, but around the world, because that's what we need, brother.
Absolutely. Andrew Brady, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick.
You know, again, the website, usilive.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Andrew's name. It'll take you right there. Amazing, amazing guy right there. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no. They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seem limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.thericksmithshow.com.
Here's that
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight. The Rick Smith Show.
You can never give up the fight. You know, one of those things that Andrew just said there just made me stop and think about, you know, something my grandfather had told me back, you know, that you know, he remembers guys telling him back in, you know, the turn of the 19th century. One of the guys that was the head of the York Labor Council, Dick Boyd, was like in his late 90s. Said when he was a kid, his father used to take him under the railroad bridge, and my grandfather told the same stories. It was illegal. You got blacklisted, and we're almost at that point right now. We're almost at the point right now where if you say you say the dreaded U word, union, you're blackballed. Good luck. You're out the door, and the laws are so weak right now. Because we've allowed politicians to pander to these special interests. And what Barry Kaufman was talking about, you know, when these big corporate special interests are funding the campaigns, when the Koch brothers are paying the freight, when you're seeing all of this stuff going on around you, is it any surprise that all of the rules go their way? Is it any surprise that organizing becomes that much harder because they're pushing laws to make it that much harder? Just like right now, they want to make talking to your coworkers stalking. And there are those in our legislature who think, that's a good idea, because they're our political enemy. Not understanding that you're destroying the economy of our nation. You're destroying a middle class. And when I was in Toledo, honestly and truthfully, you saw it right in front of you. You saw big, beautiful, ornate houses, massive structures, beautiful structures. And then you saw a bunch of boarded up houses, blight, poverty. You saw all of this stuff. And my daughter picked up on it. She's like, Dad, what the, you know? And I'm going, well, this is what happens when you have this kind of concentration of wealth going into the hands of a few. It just is what it is. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
In a major speech on trade policy at the Center for American Progress Tuesday, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka called for a global New Deal and trade policies designed to create a virtuous cycle for working people worldwide.
We need new policies to spark a virtuous cycle where rising wages fuel demand, not flimsy debt-driven demand, but healthy demand, which in turn spark business investment and more jobs and higher wages in a strong cycle of global growth that works for all our families, for the environment, and for our communities. We need a global New Deal, a worldwide program to bring the basic infrastructure of modern society, electricity, water, schools, roads, internet access, to everyone on Earth.
Trumka says what we now have instead are failed NAFTA-style trade policies that by design hurt workers across the world while enriching multinational corporations.
You see, NAFTA put corporations in charge of America's economic strategy with the goal of shipping jobs offshore to lower labor costs. The big trade deals since then used NAFTA as a starting blueprint, from the WTO to our bilateral relationship with China to the recent agreements with Korea and Colombia and Panama. The model is simply not working. It's not working here in the United States. and it's not working with most of our trading partners. And we have a lot of work to do to make this model work for working families, both in changing the rules and learning how to enforce them effectively. The model chronically starves the productive sector and working families while it fuels financial bubbles and busts, after which working people everywhere struggle to provide for themselves and for our families.
Supporting the Give America a Raise bus tour, New England organizer for the Alliance of Retired Americans, Jennifer Kinney, says that raising the minimum wage affects far more than just those working at that wage level.
The reason we would want to be involved with raising the wage is for several reasons, actually, because that absolutely ties in with retirement security. The more folks can earn during their work years, that they'll have higher Social Security when the time comes to retire.
The Give America a Raise bus tour is traveling to 18 cities in 11 states.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you is like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Yeah, you hear that quite often. You know, you hear it from the rhetoric that the right wing spews out. Well, you know, they're not worth much more than that. It's the meritocracy, their skills, right? Hear that nonsense all the time. Yeah, but when you start talking about, well, how little are you willing to work for? Well, much, much more superior than that. Which is why I thought it was great that today the folks at Americans United for Change rolled their bus tour through Reading, Pennsylvania on the way to Philadelphia. The Give America a Raise bus tour right through here through the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I've got one of the folks on the line from the group Americans United for Change. It's their digital director. We've got Jimmy D'Onofrio on the line. Jimmy, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it is my pleasure to be on with you. Thank you so much for having us.
So tell me, what is this? I get it. Give America a raise. What's the tour supposed to do?
Well, we're going to 11 states, making 19 stops, and we don't only want to get the word out to people, letting them know, you know, how this impacts real people around America. We want to hit targets. People like Jim Gerlach in Pennsylvania and Pat Toomey. And we want to let them know, hey, this is something that is positive for your state, positive for your constituents. You should be supporting this. You should get behind this. And we need your help to get this passed. So it's not just about getting the word out, but it's about kind of urging Congress to get their act together.
Yeah, and you know, to me, and I go back to the day President Obama took office, on the air I said the one thing that I hope for his presidency is that he returns the reward of work to people. Because even then, when he took office, you saw wages were still declining, people were struggling, we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. And I remember saying at the time, when the jobs come back, they've got to be jobs that pay a reasonable wage, and that we don't end up where we are right now, with families struggling, needing to ask for help from our government. To me, the reward of work should be, if you work hard, you play by the rules, you're able to put food on the table and a roof over your head, bottom line.
Yeah, it's about the dignity of work, really. We think of low-wage jobs as fast food, and stocking shelves and stuff like that. But there's nothing wrong with those jobs. Those are that's a service to the rest of the country. You know, to the people who don't make low wages. They go out and they buy that food. They buy those goods on those shelves. And it's also people who change bedpans for, you know, our elderly and people in hospitals. So it's to think that, to demean people by saying that low-wage work, you know, is deserving of a low wage, it's silly, because all work, all hard work, deserves the kind of wage that will give people dignity, make them want to come to work every day, make them happy with their lives, and be able to provide for their family.
You know, I listened to the right wing, the NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Business Folks, their trumped up studies that say, you know, the minimum wage worker, that just some pimply faced teenager, just seen some granny who's, you know, a little bingo money. These aren't real people who need these jobs to support real families. It's just pin money, so to speak.
It's unbelievable because the average age in the United States of a minimum wage worker is 35 years old. These aren't entry-level jobs anymore. These are jobs everywhere that people need. And sometimes they have one and two and three of them just to get by. So it's not about teenagers. Teenagers, yes, we think that a hardworking teenager should also make a living wage. There's no reason for them not to. But it doesn't matter if you're 16 or 66. You know, you deserve the dignity to make a wage that you can live on.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, there's the other argument that they make is, well, if you're going to raise it to $10 an hour, why not just raise it to $100 an hour or $1,000 an hour or who knows? We could just set the minimum anywhere. What do you say to someone who would make a statement like that?
I would try to calm them down first. This isn't about breaking the bank for small businesses and, you know, making large corporations angry by, you know, going out of our way to make a ridiculous request like that. 10-10 is a living wage. You know, that gives people $21,000 a year.
And where'd you get that? Where did you get that number at? Where did this living? Because we hear a lot about a living wage. How do you determine what a living wage in this country is?
Well, you know, there's a great tool that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology created. It's the Living Wage Calculator, and it will calculate the average cost of living for food, transportation, housing, medical care, everywhere in the country. And so we've looked everywhere in the country at every stop to see, you know, exactly what it costs to live there, what it costs to send your kids to school, to go out and get groceries. And, you know, that's been a really important tool because it's really justified all of our arguments. Now, I'll give you an example. We just left Reading, Pennsylvania, a few hours ago.
The poorest city in the country.
Yeah, and you know what? A living wage there is $17,160 a year. And at minimum wage, you're only making $15,080 a year. Now, we're forcing people who work full-time to live in poverty, to raise their families in poverty. And that's not fair. It's really not fair. And, you know, that's just Reading. Talk about a big city. We're headed to Philadelphia in the morning. Their living wage is almost $21,000. You know, so we're not giving people a chance to succeed. And the other thing is, you know, when people work two or three minimum wage jobs just so it can add up so they can survive, how are they supposed to move on to a bigger job? How are they supposed to get an education? They can't do better because they don't have time.
I'm with you. You know, I've heard all of these arguments. Another one I wanted to get your thought on is we hear the mechanization argument. If we raise the minimum wage and if we don't give these low-wage employers cheap labor, in fact, you've got folks who want to do away with the minimum wage. If people are desperate enough to work for a buck an hour, they think that's a good thing. But the argument is that if you set the minimum wage too high, people are going to mechanize. I've always argued that, well, they're going to mechanize no matter what. I don't know what the minimum wage has to do with it, but I'm curious what your thought is.
Well, yeah, there's really no way to predict the future. There have been studies that say that, you know, minimum wage jobs could possibly be the ones that, you know, mechanize easier than, you know, the high-paying jobs. But, you know, there's always going to be a service industry. There's always going to be small businesses that need laborers. Not everybody has the opportunity to mechanize. And, you know, that's an argument for big corporations who are already making these unbelievable profits every year. They don't need to threaten the American people, you know, by taking away jobs, you know, to
they're already doing it.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I'll give you an example. People will also say that stuff will cost more if we raise the minimum wage. You know, it'll cost way too much to go get a burger at McDonald's. You know, at McDonald's last year, in their third quarter, in the third quarter alone, made $1.5 billion.
Yep.
And every year, the American taxpayer is paying $1.2 billion for public assistance for just McDonald's employees. So why are we paying? Why are we paying for the burger and for them to pay their employees low wages at the same time?
So
no, we're already paying more.
Yeah. So while you're on this tour, because I've been saying for a couple of years now that we need to have the adult conversation of, are we going to support a low wage economy with LIHEAP, with food stamps, with all of the Medicaid and all of the things that we that the Walmarts of the world encourage their employees to go and get from the state? Are we going to encourage a low-wage economy and thus not complain about the taxes we pay and the services that people get from the state? Or are we going to hold these big, huge multinationals accountable and make them actually pay their true cost of what an employee costs?
Yeah, you know, Paul Ryan said the safety net was starting to turn into a hammock. And that people were getting a raise. And that's just not true. The people who make the minimum wage are hard-working people, and they want to do better, and we should give them that opportunity. And, you know, a strong safety net is good for everyone.
Yep.
Because everyone then can take a risk.
Yep.
You can take a risk and go, you know, go back to school or, you know, move somewhere where you think you have a better opportunity. You know, we have to give these people across the country the opportunity to do better. We don't want everyone to stay in a minimum wage job. That's not what this is about. We want people to be able to raise their families and pull themselves up out of poverty. And, you know, if raising the minimum wage is the way to do that, which I do believe that it is, you know, we've got to do it. We have a moral obligation.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Jimmy D'Onofrio. He is a digital director with Americans United for Change. The website for the bus tour, raisedto1010.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. As they are on the bus tour, Give America a Raise, going across here, across Pennsylvania. Let me ask you this, because you brought it up, and I like the frame that you've used, because I don't know about you. Have you ever had a fast food job? Have you ever worked in one of these places?
I actually worked in a kitchen at Friendly's once, yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, the idea that these are just kids walking around, and this is easy work, to me, is just the absolute wrong frame. This is hard work. In fact, I've often said the lower amounts of money I've ever been paid is the hardest work I ever did. The more money I seem to make, the less actual work I seem to do.
Yeah. and that's really what it is. And, you know, going back to my other point, you know, whether you're 16 or 66, I mean, it's still work. It's work. You know, people deserve to make the kind of money that work deserves. People have to have dignity when they go to work. You know, it's embarrassing to some people that they have to go to work every day, make just a little bit of scratch, and go home and do it all over again.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that they enjoy doing, but they have to. These are hardworking people that are trying to live, trying to survive.
And the other part of it is when you're at the margin like that, it's, you know, it's just one setback that throws you into homelessness or throws you into crisis. And then you go, well, why am I doing this? Why am I on this treadmill? And I have to be honest with you, Jimmy. I've been waiting for the day when working America just says, you know what? We've been on this treadmill. We can't keep up. And people just say enough already and take to the streets like they did back during the Depression and organize and say, you know what? If the law's not going to keep up, we're going to organize, we're going to join associations, guilds, unions, whatever you want to call them, and we're going to fight in the streets, as we've done in past generations.
Yeah, and, you know, you see it with small businesses now. Small businesses are realizing that their employees are important to their own bottom line. And, you know, they're small business. We've been to, I think, 9 or maybe 8 stops already, and small business owners have come to almost every stop and said, hey, we've already raised the minimum wage because it's important to us to provide a life for our employees, you know, that they can be proud of. And, you know, our first stop in Maine, a small business, a general manager of a Mexican restaurant, was talking about how happy it made him to hear that some of his employees were getting to go out with them to the movies with their girlfriend or wife or a husband, or that they were able to buy a gift for their child. Like, just really small things that people can get excited about. And, you know, I think that the small businesses of this country, and most small businesses, they want this. They want a raise in the minimum wage. And, you know, it, small businesses are where this revolution is going to start. And, you know, that's the backbone of America.
But I thought, hold on, Jimmy. Whoa. I've been told, now this is something that's been repeated often, that this is going to kill small business. This is a job creator's nightmare. It's the end of small business as we know it.
It's so silly. It's simple economics. When a person, you know, here's the thing. If you give a person more money in their paycheck, they're not going to pile it in a corner of their living room and sit on it.
No, they'll put it in the Cayman Islands.
They're going to go out and spend it at the same places they're making it. It's cyclical. If an employer pays his employees more money, then those employees take that money and put it back into small business, and small business has to hire more employees to keep up with the demand, and they give them more money, and then they pay that money right back into the small business system. You know, America's made up. The American economy isn't just some number that goes up and down with a flick of a switch. Right? Some Republicans want to simplify it that way. You know, if we do A, you know, X will have you.
Right.
That's not the way it works. The American economy is made up of a lot of different smaller economies. You know, there's big corporation economies. There's small business economies. There's family economies. There's personal economies. When we build up those smallest personal and family economies, they build up the small business economies. Those small business economies either help support the big corporation economies or they become big corporation economies. And that filters into the American economy. So, you know, we need to support the entire ecosystem, you know, of economy in this country. And to do that, we need to stimulate it. And you know, it takes a little money, but it is worth it.
Yeah. So what you're telling me then is the whole trickle-down thing not working. If you give the billionaires more tax cuts because they're smart people, they're going to run the economy, right? You're not telling me that.
They're the ones that are going to stick it in the corner of their living room and sit on it.
Or the Cayman Islands.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we keep hearing that frame. If we just more tax cuts, more bad trade policy, more of all the things that got us into this mess, as where I'm going, you know what? My grandparents' generation, they had it right. My grandmother worked, when she retired in 1985, was making $8 an hour at a place like Walmart, a small department store in Cleveland, making $8 an hour back in 85, with 6 weeks vacation, full paid medical, dental, all of that stuff, a pension that she's collecting to this day as a UFCW member. And I'm going, this is 1985.
Yeah, when was she able to retire? Like, what age?
She was 62.
Yeah, people can't retire at 62 anymore nowadays. It's almost impossible. Yeah, you know, we got to give people the opportunity to live their, you know, the twilights of their lives in comfort.
And this is the story that I think people need to hear more of, because I think it's important that we go back and we think about that, the greatest generation and what they built and the middle class that they left for the billionaires of today to steal away from us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last question I've got for you, because I know you guys are moving right along. This tour, I know you're heading to Philadelphia in the morning. What are you hoping out of this?
You know, tomorrow we're going to be speaking with AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, and I'm just hoping that, you know, he's able to really put the country on blast and say, hey, guys, you know, this is something that, you know, the members of my organization approve of. This is a small business, you know, imperative. This is something that the city of Philadelphia needs, the state of Pennsylvania needs, the country of the United States of America. We want to amplify the message that this is good for people, it's good for business, it's good for everyone. And, you know, no matter what, you know, the right wing or the big corporations, you know, with their, you know, their big, you know, they got big advertising bucks, and they're going to let you know, their opinion. But you know what? It's an opinion. And everyone's got one. We all know that some of them do. This is backed by, you know, polling know, people support this. This is backed by a ton of data. You know, here's the thing. The Center for American Progress just put out a report saying that in Pennsylvania alone, wages will increase for 1 million workers if we raise the minimum wage to 10 cents. And it'll raise it by $1.6 billion. And that's a lot of money in people's pockets. But you know what? It's also going to raise economic activity in the state of Pennsylvania by another $1 billion. So that money is coming right back out. And that's what we want people to know. You know, this money isn't going somewhere and it's lost forever. It's coming right back out to Pennsylvania business owners. And, you know, that we just want people to know this is the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. It's the economic thing to do.
It's the logical, common sense thing to do.
Absolutely.
It just is what it is. Jimmy, I appreciate you taking time for us. Best of luck on the tour, and I look forward to talking to you guys again in the near future.
Rick, thank you so much for having us. Great. We really appreciate it.
All right, great talking to Jimmy D'Onofrio. He is the digital director over at Americans United for Change. Give America a Raise bus tour. We've got a link to the website, raisetothe1010.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
We got to get over tonight. We got to do it today. No more madness than you. No more victory. We got to get over tonight.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
If one obscure college professor dies, does it make any difference? If you're Margaret Mary Voitko, yes. In life, she was just another adjunct teacher at Duquesne University, being grossly underpaid and maltreated by the school. Her story would be unknown, except for Daniel Kovalik. A lawyer with the United Steelworkers, Daniel knew Margaret Mary through his union's drive to help adjunct teachers organize for better pay and treatment. He wrote up her story, telling how Duquesne had paid her so little that she spiraled into abject poverty. Then they coldly booted her. No severance, no goodbyes. Impoverished, abandoned, scared, and stressed to the limit, her heart exploded shortly afterwards. Yet, in death, Margaret Mary is more alive than ever. Kovalik's poignant piece swept through the Internet, striking a chord with adjunct teachers everywhere. They see that their own low-wage position could put them in the same downward spiral it did for her. So Margaret Mary's story is being repeated all across the country, energizing organizing campaigns to empower and lift up these hard-hit university teachers. In a case of beautiful irony, one of their strongest campaigns is taking place at Duquesne. Adjuncts there have already voted to join the Steelworkers Union, but the domineering masters of this Catholic school are resorting to devious legalistic ploys to deny simple justice for their faculty. Bizarrely, they've even demanded a religious exemption from our labor laws, claiming that unionization would interfere with our teaching of Catholic values. This is Jim Hightower saying the Steelworkers Union president, Leo Gerard, has appealed that claim, not to the courts, but to the Pope. And to make his case that Pope Francis should speak out on this issue of social justice, Gerard told him the story of Margaret Mary Voitko. So in death, Margaret Mary even met the Pope.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Business as usual. Yep. gated communities. I keep saying they better, the Koch brothers and their ilk, the billionaire ilk who are destroying the middle class, they better stay within their gated communities because, you know, you go back and you learn the history of the Great Depression. This country was being ripped apart, shred by shred, brick by brick. You don't think the New Deal came about out of the benevolence of the goodness of FDR's heart? No, it was politically what had to happen. It had to happen because this country was being shred. And the people in their gated communities realized that you can have your castles, but people do storm the castles. You know, the French Revolution comes to mind. There are moments when the elite's heads end up on platters. And now, don't take this as I'm calling for violence. I am not. I am simply stating what reality should already let us know. That we are becoming two very different societies. And this isn't anything new. This has been going on for a couple of generations now. Only it was slower for a while. Now it's accelerating. And, you know, you go back to 2004 when John Kerry and John Edwards ran. John Edwards, when he was running for the presidency, he was saying, look, there are two Americas. And when my daughter and I were in Toledo, we saw a very stark world, two very different worlds. So when I saw this story over the weekend in The Guardian, made me scratch my head and go, maybe it's just not here in the U.S. Maybe it's globally. A new study sponsored by NASA, the Goddard Space Flight Center, pointing out that we've got some serious economic divides, some resource exploitation going on, and that you better watch out because we could be in for a collapse. Or as the study says, now they didn't want to get into the fringe arguments of, wow, there's going to be a collapse and civilization's going to end as we know it. But they did say the process of rise and collapse is actually a recurrent cycle found throughout history. And they pointed out a number of these cases, and they said cases of severe civilization disruption due to precipitous collapse, often lasting centuries, have been quite common. Now, this research project is based on this new cross-disciplinary handy method, they call it the Human and Nature Dynamical Model. It's the handy model. And it's a mathematics and a whole bunch of natural science and social scientists come up with this number and these findings. And what they said is, you know, the Roman Empire and the equally, if not more advanced, Han and Moran and Gupta empires, as well as many of the advanced Mesopotamian empires, are all testimony to the fact that advanced, sophisticated, complex, and creative civilizations can be both fragile and impermanent. Now, what they're basically saying is, look, the distribution of wealth, the distribution of resources, the distribution of, you know, food and water and energy and all of that stuff could lead to a massive collapse. And what they write is the stretching of resources due to the strain placed on the ecology carrying capacity, the economic stratification of society into elites and masses, you know, the very wealthy and the poor and everybody else. They write these social phenomena have played a central role in the character or the process of collapse in all such cases over the last 5,000 years. So, you know, basically, and you go through and you read this through this whole very lengthy study put out by these really bright people who are saying, hey, over here, stupids. This massive inequality, this race to the bottom, this hooray for me and screw everybody mentality is going to screw us all. we're all going to suffer from this, and we could, if not careful, could see a collapse. Now, are you surprised by this? Because, you know, I talk to people that are, oh, that could never happen. We're so much more superior. But you got to wonder, you know, at some point, how much of what we're burning, how much of the resource that we're wasting, how much can it continue? So it was interesting to see that and to have that thought come into our mind as we start thinking about where we go into the future. The status quo cannot continue. The wealth divide that we currently have cannot continue. And maybe it's only when, heads are on sticks that things change. I hope not. Anyway, I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Right. The Rick Smith Show.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
So this story from Evanston, Illinois, caught my attention earlier today because it's one of those things that always make me laugh. That you know, you've got these school administrators who are trying to keep the purity of the young ladies by having these insane dress codes. Can't wear shorts, can't wear leggings or yoga pants, or too tight, they're a distraction. And I'd always wonder, a distraction to who? Well, they actually said it's a distraction to the boys in the class because they obviously can't keep their eyes to themselves. And now they've got the students and the parents at this middle school, the Haven Middle School in Evanston, Illinois. About 500 people have signed on to this protest petition, protesting this new dress code, targeting only girls. And that's what they're really upset about. And one of the posters that they showed a picture of is, it said, are my pants lowering your test scores? Which kind of interesting. One of the 13-year-old students there was quoted as saying, my not being able to wear leggings because it's too distracting for boys is giving us the impression we should be guilty for what guys do. And I'm going, it's so important that you teach them young that everything is going to be their fault. She said they just want to be comfortable. Parents not very happy. Because they said it sends the wrong message to girls. I kind of agree. They should have across the board dress codes so that hemlines and necklines equally with boys. So when boys have to wear dresses, maybe everybody has to wear a dress on that day below the knee. Don't talk about distraction. I went to Catholic school. The distraction was all the girls wore shorts or wore the dresses just below the knee. But there was Friday flip-up day. You want to talk about distraction? There, my friend. Very much so, distraction. Anyway, let's find out what's really important around the world. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, what do you think?
Oh, man, I have a... I would say that a Catholic school uniform form is much more distracting than mere yoga pants any day of the week. And as soon as, you know, schools inspire sort of a, burqa dress code, I'm sure that'll be fetishized just as soon. So I don't think there's really any way to win.
Yeah, I think it's just dumb. And then by having these moments, what you do is you cause more attention to it. And I'm like, you know, why? There's so many other things that we should be worrying about.
No, certainly. I mean, if we look at the problems facing our public schools, I think that's probably one of the more better ones when it comes to self-expression. And, I'm just glad that I was able to go to a school where I could, wear skulls and my black fingernail polish and all that stuff without much grief from the administration itself.
And it shouldn't be the administration who mocks you. It should be your peers.
I love that too. So there we are.
It's like these kids today with you. I guess I'm just old. I don't get the whole, what's with the earlobe things where there's like a half dollar sitting in their earlobes? Have you seen this?
Gauging, yeah. No, I've dated a few girls with pretty big gauges. It's not my cup of tea. I had a lip ring and an eyebrow ring when I was, a little bit younger. I had to take that out as soon as I started in Washington, D.C., however. But, whatever floats your boat, I guess.
Yeah, see, I guess it's because I grew up in a housing project where you fought every day. And I see somebody with something to grab onto in their ear as just an advantage for me to throw you on the ground, or the lip ring, or the nose, or the eyebrow, or the chain, any of that stuff. Just a good advantage in any good fight.
That's very true. I guess my mom went to high school in Oakland, and she would tell me about how girls would wear dangly earrings with razor blades on it to stop anybody from ripping for that in a fight. And, maybe that was a pretty good technique.
There you go. And see, they adapt. See, I maybe thought about that. Anyway, what's going on around the world? I understand the Obama administration has extended the deadline to sign up for Obamacare. And I got to be honest, I am not surprised.
This is the latest move that we've seen from the administration to sort of put back the deadline by a good chunk of time in light of the fact that, it hasn't had the exact numbers that they've been expecting. This one is based around fears that there are quite a few Americans who tried to sign up or were otherwise unable to now are getting a little bit of a grace period to do that. The administration was a little bit shaky on the details. They did not say whether or not they were going to ask for verification or if it was going to be based on the honor system. But nevertheless, it does benefit them in the sense that it is going to be able to get more people on after that very strict March 31st deadline.
And as soon as I saw that story come into my inbox, immediately every insane right-wing conservative Tea Party group had a statement on it, all the flip-flop and all this and all that, almost like it was the end of the world, without remembering that if I remember correctly, when Bush rolled out the Part D, there were some extensions there, weren't there?
There certainly were. And it's also worth noting that, a lot of the actions that we've seen in the House haven't necessarily been strictly around, repealing the individual mandate. It has been based on delaying it for anywhere for up to a year. So it's a little hypocritical to say on one side of your mouth that you're trying to fix the law by pushing back the mandate while also criticizing the president for doing exactly what you voted for.
Well, hypocrisy, nothing new, but still, I think this is a smart decision. Given the technical problems they had, I think a smart decision.
No, certainly true. This did have a very shaky rollout. Nobody really appreciated it. It did not, get up to par for quite some time. But now it is up, and, they've been trying to combat the initial skepticism that came with it. There were a lot of people who were discouraged right from the outset, and this is a way to try to right that wrong.
And now you're starting to see some pretty high-profile folks coming. I saw that LeBron James is actually out pushing people, going, hey, you might want to sign up for this?
Exactly. The entire basis for a lot of this was you know, young people, of course, need to sign up for this, exchange program in order to keep insurance rates low for, insurance rates low for everybody else. And, that's, of course, why we saw, Zach Galifianakis from the Hangover Association, coming out and, not necessarily, endorsing it, but helping the administration with its goal.
Yeah, did you watch the video? I didn't get it.
Oh, I did. I loved it. You didn't like it?
It was slow. And for a generation that is supposed to be short-term minded, very, what am I looking for? A short attention span. It just seemed very slow and predictable and kind of like, and I don't watch the, I had never seen the two palm things before. But
Ferns.
Just
for Ferns,
is
on.
That what it
you
is?
Have to get with the young people.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry, I had never seen it, and I just it didn't do anything for me.
No, I understand. I actually watched it with my boss Ellen Ratner, who I'm sure your listeners are well aware of, who is a little bit older than me. She's in her 60s. I'm 27, and we actually had a pretty big fight about it in the office over whether or not it was funny. She maybe cracked a smile twice during it since I showed it to her. At the end of the day, she, was sort of chastising me and our interns for thinking it was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
I'm not going to chastise you for it. I'm not going to chastise you for it. If your generation gets it and it's their thing, look, there are a lot of things that my parents' generation never got when I was younger. If it gets people to sign up, if it gets people, then, mission accomplished. We can break out the Bush banner and the socks for the drawer and the whole nine yards.
No, yeah, sure. I mean, because, when Elvis came out when you were probably in your late 20s, I'm sure that freaked out quite a bit of people.
No, Elvis was almost dead before I was around. He died in 77. I was 10. So
whatever you want to tell your viewers or your listeners.
There you go. Well, it is what it is. So let's move along. I understand the Democrats are going to put out a new agenda, something that I've been saying, I don't know, for the last 10 years they should have been doing. But, hey, I guess better late than never, right?
Exactly. This is something that, the Democrats announced today. This is, of course, coming fresh off of the announcement from Nate Silver that Democrats have a 60% chance of losing the House to the Republicans. And this is sort of them doubling down on some of the, more enticing rhetoric that is expected to bring the diehard base out to the, polls come the midterm elections. This is new agenda that's pretty far-reaching. It includes raising the minimum wage, passing paycheck fairness legislation to ensure that women are, receiving equal pay. And it also includes other things such as easing student loan debt, investing in the infrastructure, and trying to make the tax rate a little more fair. And, of course, the political implications of this were not lost on reporters, nor was the Senate really willing to admit that this was, purely something that they could think could actually be done. Chuck Schumer said that, yes, this is going to, certainly throw a bone to the base, but these are pretty popular, programs that will actually have an impact in red states. And he also noted that although none of this is really going to pass in the House, this is going to be a pretty effective tool to draw a contrast between Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate, as well as in the lower chamber.
Yeah, I hear you say that. I go, I guess better late than never. But, where were you, 2, 3, 4, 5? Where were you 5, 6 years ago? Where have you been?
That's a very good point. And a lot of this stuff is not necessarily new. Of course, minimum wage has sort of become the new battle cry in the face of the 2014 elections. But we have seen a lot of this stuff come up time and time again. The most recent example, of course, is the president's job speech. That was pretty much dead on arrival because, a lot of middle-of-the-road Democrats in the Senate were not really willing to, take that as their mantelpiece. And, of course, the House rejected that on the face of it. It does make sense considering the, turnout that we see for 2014. For midterm elections, of course, we see only the most diehard people coming out during, presidential election years. We see everybody and their mothers heading to the polls. So it does make sense to try to, rile up the base, although it is, as you have mentioned, maybe a little bit too late.
But here's the thing. I mean, you should be riling the base all the time. You should be getting them active and engaged and pushing for the things that you believe in, not just during election times. If you truly believe that we should be increasing the minimum wage, you should be doing that. If you truly believe that I should have paycheck fairness instead of this paycheck destruction like we've got going on around this country, you should be pushing for that, not just at election time, but all the time. It should be one of the core tenets of the party.
No, I mean, that's a very good point. And, again, you know, they have had some quite some time to try to spread this message, but it is sort of getting to a, you know, desperate time for them, so I'm not necessarily surprised to see this really being put front and center.
No, we're desperate, so we're going to give the people what they actually want. Wow.
Exactly. Welcome to D.C.
Yeah, which is why I don't like living there, and I wouldn't want to. So let's move along. So the mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, arrested for bribery, only 6 months in, huh?
Exactly. He was elected, a little bit under 6 months ago, taking over from Anthony Fox, who was tapped by the Obama administration to serve as transportation secretary. And this mayor Cannon was found to according to investigators, to have accepted about $48,000 in bribes as well as gifts. These included a good chunk of money in the form of cash, as well as, vacation time, hotel rooms, as well as the use of a private apartment in Charlotte in a sort of luxury suite type deal. And this is apparently not anything new. This has been a four-year-long investigation dating back to when he was serving on the, city council and was allegedly giving access to, zoning board officials and other city types in exchange for these gifts. And the most recent one, of course, was about $20,000 once he became mayor. So this is something he has been doing in the short time he has been in office.
Well, you go, why? Given all of the stories you see across the country, who would be dumb enough to do something like this? I guess I don't really need the answer to that, do I?
No, it is a very good question. You know, this is somebody who, quite likely could have had a good career ahead of him. The mayor for Charlotte has been sort of a good, stepping stone for quite a few people.
Yeah.
So it really does boggle the mind why he would jeopardize himself like this.
Well, here's my message for him. Good luck in prison. Don't drop the soap.
There we go.
And finally, the NSA claims it's not spying on Jimmy Carter.
Yes, this came out last night. Keith Alexander, General Keith Alexander, the director for the NSA, said that the agency is not reading emails between Carter and foreign heads of state after Jimmy Carter said that he has not been sending emails out of fear that they could be intercepted by the NSA or whatnot. So he's instead been using the traditional postage system. Alexander added, and something that seems a little too enticing, it's okay for Carter to resume sending emails, which is a little bit comedic on the face of it to hear the NSA director urging someone to go ahead and send those emails. And today we also saw a little bit more news coming from Carter, wherein he said that if he was president, he would be open to pardoning Snowden, although he acknowledged that he has not necessarily seen enough information in his post-presidency role to know exactly what sort of national security impact the documents released by Edward Snowden have ultimately resulted in.
Yeah. I find it interesting, though, that he's going to use the Postal Service, which, they've been opening letters for years. They have a mechanism for that. If they really wanted to read what you're saying, they'll find a way.
I'm sure they will. There we go.
It is what it is. Justin, always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we, the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein.
In response to a delay to the Affordable Care Act, Fox News began attacking the Obama administration, despite the similarities to delays by other presidents. On Fox's The Kelly File, host Megyn Kelly criticized the limited extension granted by the administration, saying,
"The end of March is supposed to be it. They were supposed to be very happy with the number of signups. It was all going great. The website was working perfectly. And now we get a report tonight, we're going to have another extension." Didn't they go to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend their mandate that people must have it and they have to be fined and it's a tax if they don't pay? Now it's, if you could just make them give us a promise ring, Supreme Court.
In reality, these types of administrative delays are nothing new. When former President George W. Bush was implementing Medicare Part D in 2006, the Bush administration also waived penalty fees for signing up late for Medicare drug coverage. While this delay is almost the same situation, Fox still used it as an opportunity to smear the Affordable Care Act and the Obama administration. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackman.
We've been talking about military photographer Bill Jones and his end-of-war mission to photograph Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The officers accompanying him were energized by curiosity and sensed the importance of the mission. But the 20-year-old photographer said he didn't think about the significance of what he was doing at the time. He was just doing his job. Yet he did have some feel for the historical importance of what was going on just from being around the older officers. Enough so that he did something significantly different in his photo development procedures. He would move negatives through trays of fluids, a shortstop bath, removal of unexposed silver, and then add military data and information that included secret classification. But this time, he made himself a pre-official print to keep with no secret classification, then printed the official versions. Join us again for the classified photos. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
When you get down, the sounds of the clothes.
Maybe you can't, but you can sure try. I'm sure, you know, you look around the world, you look at all the Occupy stuff, you look at any time people take to the streets, man, the clubs come and the beatings start. Yes, the makes, the sound cannons, all of the goodbye gun. Oh, thank you, Iraq, for all of the wonderful, toys that we get to use on We the People. Very interesting. And the whole reason I bring this up is, and thanks, John, for pointing out, that today is the anniversary of Coxey's Army, 1894. What you had is this guy, Jacob Coxey, who led some 1,000 unemployed people from, I think it was Youngstown, Ohio.